Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Normally, that music's indicative that something's bothering me. So, the whole cancel culture, the whole the 1619 project, right, that academics have gone to the New York Times and said, hey, this stuff is just factually wrong. To me, those are symptoms. Right, those are symptoms of what happens when the institutions in a government, and those institutions have a function in our government. They teach, they inform. And so these are just the issues of the day. Going forward, there will be other issues. What will they be? What will they be? And so, kind of in my head, and we'll talk about it here in a little bit. But as I read, Donald Trump and the pushback. Donald Trump was elected because Americans across the country feel disconnected from Washington, D.C. And so they looked at all the different candidates on the Republican ticket in 2016, and they said, you know what? We'd rather roll the dice with him than throw back in with Jeb Bush and the rest of you clowns, okay? Because we all see you as the same. So in spite of, you know, his craziness that he puts out there, Americans elected Donald Trump. Pretty disturbing, though, with some of the intelligent stuff that's coming out, in that you had people, and it seems to include the President of the United States, Barack Obama at the time, who were informed that this thing was an attempt to throw attention. The whole Trump thing is a Clinton invention attempting to throw light in a different direction other than her email server and her integrity, which she couldn't stand the scrutiny. Right. So anyway, and that was the reason for my nausea on on election day, and why I wasn't watching the election results. I could not stand the thought of Hillary Clinton becoming president of the United States. Clearly better Donald Trump than her. To me, she is the embodiment of just what corrupt the Clintons are. I mean, they're good at playing the game, but just, oh my God, just disgusting. So anyway, so Donald Trump gets elected, and you have institutions. I mean, the more evidence that comes out relative to the FBI and the Department of Justice, I mean, wow. So Donald Trump is used as a pretense for people to not live up to the oath they swore to live up to. And the thing about that oath is you don't get to pick and choose. You're supposed to do that all the time. So Donald Trump and his, whatever you call him, is used as the rational basis why we don't have to live up to our oath. It also coincides with what's gone on in our, how do I say this? What's gone on, I like my longer microphone cord. I can roam around and walk and talk. I was swinging a baseball bat the other day while I was doing the show, so it makes me happy. But anyway, so to me, and what I want to talk about is liberal institutions in a democracy. I don't want to talk about, I'm not into talking about partisan shit. I'm a student of institutions in our democracy, and so what has happened? So again, so you see people not living up to their oaths. How does it, so because of the election of Donald Trump, and people are so aghast at that. Can you imagine what will happen if he's reelected? Now, I don't know that he will be. I see things that tell me there's great dissatisfaction in the country, and not all of it is with him. For instance, the amount of gun sales across the country and ammunition sales. You can't buy it. So how will that impact the election? Now, we've seen people screw the polls up before. Although the difference in the poll this time, and we'll see if it gets closer as the election draws closer, but the difference in the polls this time is beyond the statistical deviation of the poll itself. So, if Donald Trump may succeed in getting the American people to do something that they would had no interest doing in the past. And when I say no interest, I mean zero interest in. And that is electing Joe Biden as a president of the United States. Yeah. Joe Biden, if you look at his runs, I mean, gets virtually like 1%, 2%, you know, in the Democratic primaries, and then drops out every time. Clearly he's not. So Donald Trump has made him somehow or other appealing. And Bernie Sanders and the far left wing of the Democratic Party have somehow or other, the miracle of Joe Biden, right? And that's what it is. He was the least offensive of a whole series of candidates that, you know, after you win the Democratic primary and you have to come back to the center, they couldn't get to the center. They were too far left. So who does that leave? Everybody looks around and it's like, oh my God, no, not him. Trump will kill him. Well, guess what? The walking landmine that is Donald Trump, right? So picture a landmine, you know, with a million charges in it, with feet and then with hands. And it is colored orange, by the way. So anyway, Yeah, he can't get out of his own way in order to. I saw, I think Ben Shapiro said yesterday, the key with Biden is give him the stage and let him be Joe Biden. He'll blow it up on himself. That's what you have to do. Get out of his way. But the president can't do that. He cannot not be the center of the stage. And he'll lose. If he loses, he'll lose because of that. Because the country does not like Joe Biden. Another thought struck me last night. In this racist country we supposedly live in. So, there's a black woman on the Democratic ticket. Not even an issue in our country. Not even discussed. I mean, in some cases it's anecdotal, right? Black woman. So in theory, we're not afraid to elect a black woman to be the vice president of the United States. We've elected a black man twice to be the president of the United States, but we're a racist country, right? And it's such a crock of shit. But you can't say that. You can't say that. You know, this honest discussion about race that everybody's begging for, you can't have it. Because when you push back on any of it, you get called a racist. But this whole concept of articulate, measured discourse. So Donald Trump gets elected, and newspapers now, liberal newspapers, New York Times at the front, and Washington Post, they don't believe that they have to live up to whatever ethical professional thing that they do, they don't believe that they have to do it. And so they believe that their higher responsibility is to be activists for change. Okay? And so their news department no longer reports news. Their news department now becomes their advocates. And the pretense of this becoming an overt thing is Donald Trump's danger to the nation. And I'm going to submit to you that there's a greater danger to the nation. And the New York Times is emblematic of that greater danger. Now, the other piece of this, in my opinion, is our university. In our universities, you're supposed to be able to go there and discuss things. It is not supposed to be simply the political platform of liberals, right, to shut down, you know, discourse. And you're supposed to entertain this broad discussion at universities. I remember doing that. And I remember, you know, listening to different points of view. It's one of the experiences that you have in college. Well, what happens when universities don't see that as their thing anymore? That they see their activism as their primary function. So these institutions that are supposed to reinforce values of free speech, respect for free speech, critical thinking, a bias for the facts. And then we do have places when you want to go, you know, when you want to go to the opinion section, there's places for you to go. But what happens when these other things that have been kind of pillars in our democracy, what happens when instead of in the department you have the resident radical, what happens when the majority of people in the department, the English department, right, the philosophy department, what happens when they're all liberal? And that's their mantra. To the exclusion of any kind of discourse that stresses, that has an emphasis on free speech and the inclusion of all opinion. What happens? And so you can see the birth of the cancel culture. So what happens? What happens to a country? Now, let me throw one more thing in there. The NBA ratings are down 45%. And there's all kinds of people who don't want to recognize the gorilla in the room. They want to say, well, you know, that the, the COVID thing. Well, what do you mean the COVID thing? Everybody's at home. They're looking for things to watch. Well, sports have been trending down. Not 45%. Well, you know, the Major League Baseball's plan and the NFL's plan and blah, blah. So, look. People that I know aren't watching because they're tired of getting political opinion stuffed down their throat when all they did was wanted to watch. It's the same reason why nobody watches the Oscars anymore. But there's very few people that will throw that carcass in the center of the room and talk about it. It's just straight up denied. Can't be the case. What? And so to me, when you put that together, what happens to the country? What happens to the country when your university system is dysfunctional? Your university system is a breeding ground for a lie. And the lie is this critical race theory that we're all racist. And so, I dare you to go around the country and find a country like ours. Doesn't exist. And the fact that this theory can be shoved down, which is a racist theory, you know, it's amazing that it could be shoved down everybody's throat. And there can be no pushback is testament to how far this has gone. So our universities have been taken over by this stuff. Be on campus and push back against this stuff and watch what happens. You'll get fired. As a writer, if you put your hand up in an NBA post-game event and you said, hey, LeBron, I want you to comment because, I think the 900-pound gorilla in the room is – you know, between your statements and the statements of many others, you have turned people off to watching the NBA to the tune of 45% decrease, an all-time low since they started recording this stuff, relative to the finals when a marquee franchise with the game's marquee player is playing it. And I think everybody knows why. Do you care to comment on that? Nobody's going to ask. Nobody's going to even ask that. And that's where we are as a nation. Where does this take us down the road? And what will be the next thing that gets shoved down the throats of Americans? That isn't true. And so again, I go back to that, you know, they came for the guy on the corner. And I did nothing. They came for the man across the street two houses down, and I did nothing. And then they came for me, and there was nobody there to help. And so I can't remember. I wish if somebody knows what that is, send that to me, because I see that as what's going on in our country today. The lack of tolerance in this country. People feel that they have, and again, I go back to my first really recollection of it is what happened in Berkeley when it was Ann Coulter and Ben Shapiro, there were riots, and it was the first time I remember seeing people dressed in black, people smashing windows, And then they said, yeah, they're not going to be allowed to speak here. When that day comes in this country that violence stops that, think about that. During the civil rights movement, we didn't allow violence to stop. What a lot of Americans knew was right. We didn't allow that. And so what I see is I see these rioters in cities around the country. They're moving across state lines, but I don't see anybody arrested for it. How are they communicating? What are they doing? I don't see anybody arrested for conspiracy, so where the hell is the FBI? Aren't they supposed to be involved in stuff like this? And you know it's a racket. You know there's people that are coordinating it. But when you see that kind of rioting and that kind of organization and nothing happens, are we shocked when it happens for 100 nights in Portland? And all it is, it's the crazies going off and you have a weak mayor there. They won't do the right thing. And it's been allowed to fester and fester and fester. So where does this go? And I don't know. I don't have an answer for that. All I know is when you see an organization, a news organization like the New York Times, doing the things they're doing, that's pretty scary stuff. And I'm going to read you. I've read this guy, and he's becoming a favorite of mine. So yesterday or the day before, his name's James Freeman. Anyway, so he appears in the Wall Street Journal on occasion. Let me read you one piece, and I'll read you. Then I'll talk about James Freeman. Anyway, I read something of his a couple weeks ago. Here's another headline: "The cancel mob comes back for more." Quote: "Anti-colonial ideologues bully another publisher into nixing one of my research projects." Written by a guy named Bruce Gilley. Who's Bruce Gilley? Mr. Gilley is a professor of political science at Portland State University and a member of the board of the National Association of Scholars. Okay, so these are scholar types, right? "For the second time in my academic career, I've been canceled. Last week, Lexington Books, the academic imprint of the publisher Roman and Littlefield, decided not to publish my forthcoming biography of a late colonial official entitled The Last Imperialist, Sir Alan Burns, Epic Defense of the British Empire. It came a mere 2 weeks before the book was due to ship. At the same time, Lexington Books canceled the new book series, Problems of Anti-Colonialism, of which my book was the first installment. The cancellations began September 26th with a petition that snowballed on social media. It was started by Joshua Mofwad Paul, an avowed Maoist philosopher in Toronto, whose blog is entitled Marxist-Leninist Maoist Mayhem. And the book includes the communists, and books include The Communist Necessity. By September 28th, all mention of my book had been airbrushed from the publisher's site without a word to me. For 2 days, I sought an explanation and received only silence. I requested they return to me the rights to the book, which they quickly did. Lexington then canceled the book series without explanation." Now remember, these are scholars. This erasure is very similar to my first in 2017 when the publisher Taylor & Francis withdrew my peer-reviewed article, The Case for Colonialism, from the journal Third World Quarterly. The journal's editor had received, quote, serious and credible threats of personal violence following a global petition campaign led by Farhana Sultana of Syracuse University, who tried to get Princeton to revoke my doctorate. I consented to the withdrawal in the interest of the safety of the editorial staff. The Last Imperialist is the culmination of 5 years of intense primary source research into the life of Burns, who is the governor of the Gold Coast, now Guyana, and prominent critic of rapid decolonization while serving at the United Nations after World War II. The book passed peer review with Lexington Books last December, and it carried endorsements from two giants in the field of colonial history, Jeremy Black and Tirthankar Roy. The book was already being sold to distributors and stores. The series, Problems of Anti-Colonialism, of which I was a co-editor, had also gone through a peer review process. Right? Now, peer review, when you're talking academics, national level, right? These are historians, blah, 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 blah. The series was planned as a forum for critical responses to the anti-colonial and the decolonizing intellectual projects that have become pervasive in global politics. And then in parentheses, and maybe in your workplace. My co-editor and I have received an eager response from young scholars in Africa and Asia, where the elder generation's anti-colonialism has long since worn thin. Okay, so he goes on and on. This is how he ends his piece. I attribute the ease and suddenness of my last cancellation to this year's Black Lives Matter moral panic. It has taken cultural totalitarianism to new levels, challenging the U.S. ethic of freedom. One reason I am running a free reading group for college students on critiques of the movement. The putrefaction of the university and of elite American and European culture, more generally, has made the task of rebuilding liberal institutions an urgent one. Gentlemanly appeals to open-minded debate are no longer enough. Concrete steps must be taken in law and university policy. For instance, federal funds should be withheld from colleges that force students to learn grievance studies and maintain offices of diversity, equality, and inclusion. Which brings us back to the book series. Its justification was that today's anti-colonial, post-colonial, and decolonizing narratives have become assaults on the foundation of the Enlightenment. They have dominated academia for mostly bad reasons, and they have now spread beyond the ivory tower to become agents of chaos and cultural change in society at large. The mob's takedown of the series shows its importance. The stage actors have appeared right on cue in this dramatization of what decolonizing means to free speech. Whatever the fate of our book series, freedom is needed more urgently than ever. Interesting, right? So that brings, here's a guy, an academic, who writes this scholarly paper that's peer reviewed, right? This scholarly book that's peer reviewed, and gonna talk about the perils of decolonization and everything that happens in its aftermath and blah, 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 blah. So he gets canceled. He gets canceled in a democracy that is becoming an intolerant, intellectual, totalitarian state. It's scary shit. Now, which brings me to James Freeman, right? American History and the New York Times. Now, the New York Times, everybody knows that I hate Germany. I don't hate Germans. I do hate Germany. Germany is a freeloading enabler of Russia on the continent. That's what Germany is. Largest economy, a military that does not function, freeloads off the American taxpayer. And NATO's further east. Why do we give a shit about Germany anymore? I'm not sure. But anyway, I don't like Germany. I don't like the policies of Germany, which probably says it better. The New York Times is becoming the Germany of publications for me. Right? That that Sulzberger dude, to me, is the twin brother of the mayor of Minneapolis, who's about to go front and center stage again. After Derek Chauvin was let out on bail, why would he be kept in pretrial confinement? He's got to be a flight, you know, a risk flight, a flight. Wait, it has to be risk of flight, or that he would do harm to others. If the judge doesn't feel that's appropriate, then a number gets set. If he can pay the number, he can raise the money to pay the number, then he's an American, I think. That's the system. He gets out on bail. But the problem, and you're seeing it, this theme, the problem is that doesn't fit the narrative of Facebook, and it doesn't fit the narrative of Twitter. God help us when that trial, when he's not convicted of first, second, or third degree murder. Watch that shit. Watch the meltdown, because reality isn't really what Twitter's about. Due process is not what Twitter and Facebook are about. Anyway, so that brings me to James Freeman. So now I forget, I don't know how I did this, but I forgot that how much I like James Freeman. So I see, because I'm anti-New York Times, right, I see the headline and I just start reading it. And I don't notice Freeman wrote it. So the headline is American History and the New York Times. Historians demand the return of a Pulitzer Prize. Many politicians and pillars of the media establishment are constantly urging national conversation about race. But too often such conversations seem to begin with inaccurate assertions. Take recent news coverage concerning the history of the American founding. A group of historians is now urging the Pulitzer Committee to rescind a prize awarded this year to a writer at the New York Times. In a Tuesday letter, professors at Brown, the University of Virginia, and other institutions write, and it goes through the letter that I talked about yesterday. The project, the 1619 Project, and its contentions have been repeatedly questioned by academics in relevant fields. The Wall Street Journal's Elliot Kaufman noted in December of 2019, "So wrong in so many ways is how Gordon Wood, the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian of the American Revolution, characterized the New York Times 1619 Project." James McPherson, the Dean of Civil War Historians and another Pulitzer Prize winner, said, "The Times presented an unbalanced, one-sided account and left most of the history out." Messrs. McPherson and Woods are among the scholars who wrote to the Times last winter to note the closed process surrounding the project, as well as factual errors. The scholars added, "These errors, which concern major events, cannot be described as interpretations or framing. They are matters of verifiable fact, which are the foundation of both honest scholarship and honest journalism. They suggest a displacement of historical understanding by ideology. On the American Revolution, pivotal to any account of our history, the project asserts that the founders declared the colony's independence of Britain, quote, in order to ensure slavery would continue. This is not true. If supportable, the allegation would be astounding, yet every statement offered by the project to validate it is false." So I'm reading this, but I don't know, right? I don't know. It's my guy, Freeman, that's writing it. In a separate letter to the Times, historians at Yale, Princeton, and other institutions wrote, quote, "To express our deep concern about the New York Times promotion of the 1619 Project, and noted that the problematic treatment of major issues and personalities of the founding and Civil War eras." The scholars added, quote, "We are also troubled that these materials are now to become the basis of school curriculums and the imprimatur of the New York Times. the remedy for past historical oversights is not their replacement by modern oversights. We therefore respectfully ask the New York Times to withhold any steps to publish and distribute the 1619 Project until these concerns can be addressed in thorough and open fashion. The best disinfectant? This is me. Sunlight, right? No, it's not what you're going to get here. In March, the Times did make one significant correction, though it simply labeled it an editor's note. But the historians signing this week's letter say the passage is still flawed. Quote, where Hannah, this is from the letter from yesterday, where Hannah Jones, this is the woman who won the Pulitzer Prize, right? And she's the, I don't know if she's the head of, but she's the writer at the New York Times that runs this project. Where Hannah Jones had originally written, quote, one of the primary reasons the colonists decided to declare their independence from Britain was because they wanted to protect the institution of slavery. The new text says some of the colonists. Even this softened assertion has little or no documentary basis, according to the most distinguished specialist in the world. Slavery exists until 18 whatever. The British colonies, it's not like there was just some great abolitionist sentiment in the 1600s to abolish slavery. It was the way of the world. And so, I mean, so when you read this shit, it's, and you know, but all that, they don't speak like I do, right? So they articulate it in very academic and appropriate. Historian Philip Magnus, among the signers of this week's letter, noted recently that the Times had quietly edited its material. Magnus called it stealth editing, again, to remove the claim that 1776 is not the true American founding. And amazingly, the Times prize winner is now saying that she never made the claim. In this week's letter, the historians write, the duplicity of attempting to alter the historical record in a manner intended to deceive the public is as serious an infraction against professional ethics as a journalist can commit. A, quote, sweeping, deeply reported, and personal essay, as the Pulitzer Prize Board called it, does not have the license to sweep its own errors into obscurity and remit to publish deeply reported falsehoods. And so then I see Freeman. And then I scroll up and I'm like, oh, that's Freeman. That's the guy that I like. But here's my question. My question is, where does this take us as a nation? Right? So under the pretense of Donald Trump, right, people that have been doing this stuff, I think, for a long time on the down low, now say, this is, we have to come out, the resistance, right? And not more important, right? Force Donald Trump into the sunlight, make him debate, right? Intellectual discourse, fighting it out politically. No, not that. It's by any means necessary. It's okay to shut down somebody else's free speech. It's okay to riot and loot, right? You have not seen the Speaker of the House of Representatives come out and condemn rioting anywhere. You haven't even seen her be asked about her father's dedication of a statue to Confederate leaders in Baltimore when he was the mayor. That's how gross and hypocritical and dishonest this shit is. And my question is, where does this take the country? Where does this go? Because of all things, we can't have an honest discussion about race. If you were to stand up and say, hey, look, I'm not going to say that there aren't people among us that are racist. But if you're paying attention, there is no discussion about Kamala Harris being black. There isn't a great hue and cry about her being a woman. Don't hear that. We elected a black guy twice. If you look at police chiefs and mayors from around the nation that have been in the middle of this cacophony of shit, it seems like every other one of them is black. So where is this systemic racism? In our education system run by liberals? Is that where it is? In our major cities run by liberals? Is that where it is? Show us where it is and we'll put an end to it. Oh, it's in you when your little eyelids flutter open in the morning. Oh, got it. So anyway, where does this all go? Universities don't feel like they have to be the place where we can discuss anything. Universities are now places of intolerance. And they're going to tell you how to think. And if you don't think like that, you're going to go home. And then the New York Times is not a place of truth anymore. It's a place of lies and bullshit. And balance that. You can't buy a gun in a gun shop and you can't buy ammunition because they're all bought in this country. And balance that with people have turned off watching sporting events that are overtly political. Clicked it off. So will the great middle class speak? The great middle class is shrinking. Will the great silent majority speak? And saying, yeah, we're not interested in that. Honestly, I think that they would, but I think the president alienates so many people by his behavior. We might see something that nobody ever thought could happen, and that is Joe Biden get elected as president of the United States. And it's not a pro-Biden vote. It's an anti-Trump vote. So anyway, where does that take the nation, though? A university system that is intolerant of measured, articulate, inclusive, respectful discourse. A media that has become advocates. Where does that take the nation? I guess we're going to find out. But I will tell you this. I don't think it takes it the nation any place close to being good. You can find James Freeman, Freeman, on you can find him on Twitter. Hold on. I read you his bio a few weeks ago. James Freeman is assistant editor of the Wall Street Journal's editorial page and author of the weekday Best of the Web column. He is the co-author of Borrowed Time, Two Centuries of Booms, Busts, and Bailouts at Citicorp. Recognized as the New York Times Editor's Choice and a Financial Times Business Book of the Month. He is a contributor to the Fox News Channel and the host of Deep Dive on Fox Nation. Before joining the Journal in 2007, James served as investor advocate at the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, where he encouraged the transformation of financial reporting technology to benefit individual investors. He is a graduate of Yale University. Yeah, Freeman. I like the guy. So, good morning to you. Welcome to a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio. The Mensa brothers are going to be here in about 20 minutes. And we're going to talk about the Navy. The Secretary of Defense unveiled this gigantic plan for a 500-ship Navy, which is pretty impressive. And so where's the money coming from? The last time we visited Navy shipbuilding, it was because that the Secretary of Defense would not release the Navy's numbers to Congress because the SecDef said that it was not credible the path forward was not credible. So now we're going to take that non-credible path financially and we're going to blow it up to 500 ships by 2045. And that includes unmanned type variants as well. Where does the money come from for that? I wonder. So we're going to talk about this. And we may dabble in this discussion, but what's always challenging is when I try to do this with Tim, it becomes about Trump. And I don't want to, and so I'm reluctant to talk about these things because I don't want it to be, I see this as deeper issues in our culture and where it takes us culturally, I think is not, it acts out on a current stage. But what's going on deeper in our culture and where it takes the nation is deeper than the two current political candidates. And that's kind of, we get derailed very easily. And then we start talking about politics, and that's not really what I want to talk about. So anyway, I'm not sure that we'll talk about this in the next hour. So good morning to you. I am still basking in the overglow, in the afterglow of doing post-traumatic winning with the midshipman from the University of Arizona's NROTC unit. And I had a great time yesterday, if you didn't hear me. It was awesome. A lot of them have gone through their own stuff. In fact, I got messages yesterday. The most frustrating part of doing it virtually is not being able to hang out afterwards and have them come up and talk to you and tell you very personal stories. But with that said, it was great. And that's why I wasn't on live yesterday morning. I didn't get on until about 9 something because we were doing, a Q&A afterwards. And so imagine that. I mean, they hung around after to do Q&A after they'd already listened to it for 3.5, almost 4 hours. So, yeah, no bullshit. I'm still in the afterglow of that. It was awesome. So, good morning to you. The United States Marine Corps band makes it official. And this is dedicated to James Freeman. I'm a fan. And I don't know. It's just to me, I've grown up in this country my whole life. And there's things that were always, going through the 60s and everything. I mean, free speech, that was a big deal. Right? Like, yeah, I don't know. I don't like what they say, but I'll defend the right to say it. Without a doubt. I mean, and so this whole shut down what your opponent is trying to say. I mean, I saw somebody write in an article recently. That is the activity of the Ku Klux Klan. Intimidation, intolerance. Those are the activities of racists. So this dedicated to James Freeman and the authors who signed that petition to rescind the Pulitzer Prize. The best disinfectant is sunlight. And in that democracy, that is articulate, respectful discourse that we can all watch and listen to, and then we can make up our own minds about whatever issue it is. But that's at risk in our culture now. That's at risk because reality, according to many, is what they see on Facebook and Twitter. Which makes us not a country of laws anymore, not a nation of evidence, not a nation of the rule of law. It makes us a nation of vigilante justice that's run by the opinions on Facebook and Twitter. And what has got us closer to that is that our universities are part of that now. They're part of cancel culture. The New York Times, for God's sakes, is part of cancel culture. Right? Senator Tom Cotton, his op-ed didn't meet our standards and should have never been published. That's them bowing to the totalitarian forces inside their own building. And then, what, the editor of the op-ed page, he got fired because of it. That's where we're at. That's a bad place to be. It's a bad place to be. And I find it interesting that it's academics around the country that are standing up and say, we can't do it like this. Who, most of which I would say are liberals. But even they say, this is wrong. Right? This is absolutely, positively wrong. So this is dedicated to James Freeman and all the academics that stood up and said, you know what? This is wrong. You should rescind that Pulitzer Prize. So, stay tuned.
You're betraying your whole life if you don't say what you think, and you don't say it honestly and bluntly.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
For this campus had prepared him well. I'm very confident that, thank you very much. If this was vodka, it'd be a lot better speech. But I'm not supposed to glamorize alcohol anymore, so young folks, you ignore what I just said.
We just have to execute. And we are executing every day, and Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. You got to win.
time to check the weather. Then we'll check some headlines. We'll take a break, and we'll get the Mensa brothers on. Email. Whoa. The deep thinking. The deep thinking hat on this morning. Obviously, you took the pointy one off before the show. That was impressive. As my departed father would say, the sun shines on a dog's ass every once in a while. Yes, Ohio man. Ohio man's actually a pretty smart dude. I hate to say that because he's listening. It's entitled First They Came. I'll get to that in a second. Let me do the weather first, and then we'll do that. The weather. Currently, it is sunny and 68 in Quantico. Down the coast, sunny and 80 at Camp Lejeune. 29 Palms, mostly sunny and 75, thank God. Which means clouds and 68 at Pendleton, which is wonderful. Clear, dark, and 71 at Camp Smith in Hawaii. Camp Butler in Okinawa. Dark, cloudy, 76 down under, closer to the South China Sea on the northern coast of Australia. At the home of Marine Rotational Force Darwin, it is dark, cloudy, and 80 degrees at night. Yikes, 80. And in Oslo, Norway, it is cloudy and 52. Currently at the home of All Marine Radio, it is cloudy and 69. Looking for a high today of 73, 73 tomorrow, 75 on Saturday, 75 Sunday, 87 Monday. What? Damn it. Get that shit out of here. All right. First They Came. The engraving of the confession in poetic form presented at the New England Holocaust Memorial in Boston, Massachusetts. First They Came is the poetic form of a post-war confessional prose by the German Lutheran pastor Martin Niemöller, who was born in 1892 and died in 1984. It is about the cowardice of German intellectuals and certain clergy, including, by his own admission, Niemöller himself, following the Nazis' rise to power and subsequent incremental purging of their chosen targets, group after group. Many variations and adaptations in the spirit of the original have been published in English. It deals with themes of persecution, guilt, repentance, and personal responsibility. The best known version of the confession in English are the edited versions in poetic form that began circulating in the 1950s. The United States Holocaust Memorial Museum quotes the following text as one of the many poetic versions of the speech. First they came for the socialist, and I did not speak out, because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionist, and I did not speak out, because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out, because I'm not a Jew. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. A longer version by the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust, a charity established by the British government, is as follows. And so it includes the communists, and then the socialists, then the trade unionists, then the Jews. So there's one more paragraph in it. The origin is a speech that Reverend Niemöller made. Here's a picture of him. For the Confessing Church in Frankfurt on January 6, 1946, of which this is a partial translation. The people who were put in the camps then were communists. Who cared about them? We knew it was printed in the newspaper. We knew it. It was printed in the newspaper that they came for them, right? who raised their voice? Maybe the confessing church? We thought. Communists, those opponents of religion, those enemies of Christians. Why should I be my brother's keeper? Then they got rid of the sick, the so-called incurables. I remember a conversation I had with a person who claimed to be a Christian. He said, perhaps it's right. These incurably sick people just cost the state money. They're just a burden to themselves and to others. Isn't it best for all concerned if they are taken out of the middle of society? Only then did the church as such take note. Then we started talking until our voices again were silenced in public. Can we say we aren't guilty, responsible? The persecution of the Jews, the way we treated the occupied countries, or the things in Greece, in Poland, in Czechoslovakia, or in Holland that were written in the newspapers. I believe we confessing church Christians have every reason to say, mea culpa, exclamation mark. We can talk ourselves out of it with the excuse that it would have cost us, it would have cost me my head if I had spoken out. We preferred to keep silent. We were certainly not without guilt, fault. And I asked myself again and again, what would have happened if in the year 1933 or 1934, there must have been possibly 14,000 Protestant pastors and all Protestant communities in Germany had defended the truth until their deaths. If we had said back then, it is not right that Hermann Göring simply puts 100,000 communists in the concentration camps in order to let them die, I can imagine that perhaps 30,000 to 40,000 Protestant Christians would have had their heads cut off. But I can also imagine that we would have rescued 30,000 to 40,000 people, because that is what it is costing us now. The speech was translated and published in 1947, but was later retracted when it was alleged that Niemöller was an early supporter of the Nazis. In 1976, Niemöller gave the following answer in response to a question asking about the origins of the poem. Quote, there were no minutes or copies of what I said, and it may be that I formulated it very differently, but the idea was anyhow, the communists, we still let that happen calmly, and the trade unions, we also let that happen, and we even let the social democrats happen. All of that was not our affair. Anyway. So, my thanks to Ohio Man for being really smart and sending that to me. But to me, that is what we're talking about. And so this version, the 1619 Project, right, and this you're a racist narrative that exists in this country, that's just the current. What's next? What's behind it? Because what's gone is the institutions that used to be advocates of free speech, respectful discourse, and whatnot. The advocates, the newspapers that used to think reporting was important, facts were important. Well, the famous gray lady, right, is a casualty of all that. And I don't have any time. Let me do the top five stories in Early Bird today so I can say I did some news just in case. Something major happened. The Marine Corps Assistant Commandant is positive for COVID-19, General Gary Thomas. So best of luck to him. Number two, Trump, U.S. will be out of Afghanistan by Christmas. Number three, Trump orders military, VA, and other federal agency to study the link between the pandemic and suicide. There you have it. Let me see. McNamara says isolation might have something to do with it. Number four, U.S. charges British ISIS members in deaths of American hostages. They were brought to the country yesterday, known as, quote unquote, the Beatles. I think that's an insult to the Beatles, right? I think people should say that. It's disgusting. It glamorizes what they did. Number five, U.S. warns China against a Taiwan attack, stresses U.S. ambiguity. That's the only... So let me just read you a little bit of that. The U.S. National Security Advisor warned China on Wednesday against any attempt to take Taiwan by force, saying amphibious landings were notoriously difficult and there was a lot of ambiguity about how the United States would respond. Robert O'Brien told an event at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas that China was engaged in a massive naval buildup probably not seen since Germany's attempt to compete with Britain's Royal Navy prior to World War I. Quote, part of that is to give them the ability to push us back out of the Western Pacific and allow them to engage in amphibious landing in Taiwan. The problem is that amphibious landings are notoriously difficult, O'Brien added, pointing to the 100-mile distance between China and Taiwan and the paucity of landing beaches on Taiwan. Paucity meaning the few number. It's not an easy task, and there's a lot of ambiguity about what the United States would do in response to an attack by China on Taiwan, he added. O'Brien was referring to a long-standing U.S. policy of strategic ambiguity. What the fuck is that? We're not really sure what we would do on the question of whether it would intervene to protect Taiwan. Well, since Taiwan's a sovereign nation, shouldn't the UN be part of that? Yeah. Anyway. No, because China says it will not allow that. Anyway, we'll take a break. When we come back, the Mensa brothers will join me. We'll talk about the United States Navy and a buildup that's going to get it to 500 ships. More of Almarine Radio coming up next.
We used to get together every week. She's been home from her last deployment for months now, and I haven't seen her once.